that. Just, we're going to mix it up a little bit and go in a little bit different order, but we're going to do the same thing. Everybody's going to talk for 10 to 15 minutes, and then at the end, we will have time for some questions, and you just come over here to the microphone and ask a question for these guys. So we are going to go in this order. We're going to go Carl, Amanda, Jerry, and then Jim. All righty. Thanks, everybody. 10 to 15 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. It's good they had me come first because I was confused on the topic until she just read it. I thought it was spiritual awakening rather than spiritual malady. Well, that puts you in a weird spot, doesn't it? Exactly. All right, well, let's see if we can shift this. Or maybe I'll just talk about the spiritual awakening. They can talk about the problem, and I'll just talk about the solution. How about that? Can you hear me? All right. I seem to have a really strange spiritual relationship to alcohol. I really do. We always talk about allergy, body, obsession, mind. But I believe that I also have a very strange spiritual relationship to alcohol. It's different than most people. And I believe it's the reason that I am willing to go to the gates of insanity or death for a drink. And the only way that I can describe this thing that I'm talking about, this spiritual relationship to alcohol, is the best way that I can describe it is by telling a story. I wish I could describe it another way, but I just have to tell you the story. In the year 2000, my mother called me up. I was already, I guess, in 2000, would be 13 years sober. So my mother calls me up and says, Carl, your brother and his wife and his children are spending the summer in the south of France. They have a beautiful place. Let's go visit them. We can even have our own little wing there. We will go to Iceland first and see the family farm and the museum dedicated to your great aunt, and then we'll go down to the south of France. I go, I'm in. Absolutely, I'm in. What a great trip. So we go to Iceland for about 9 days. That was a spectacular time. I've been back to Iceland maybe 7 times since. But that's not the point of the story. The point of the story happens in the south of France, and we're staying at this beautiful place that my brother and his wife and kids are at, and one of the nights, my brother says, Carl, you're driving. I'm taking everybody out for a 13-course French meal. The nannies are going to watch the kids. And you're driving, and we're going to go to this amazing French chateau in the countryside, this castle in the countryside, for a 13-course French meal. So I go, okay, I've never done that before. If you've never had a 13-course French meal, which I've never had before or since, what they do is they bring you a tiny little bit of food 13 times. That's what they do. And we're sitting in the courtyard of this amazing 1,000-year-old castle, and a string quartet is playing amazing, and it's at sunset. And they're bringing these 13 courses. With each one of these little small little bits of food, they bring this ridiculously small, tiny little glass of wine. I mean, embarrassingly small. It's ridiculous. And the waiter will tell a story about why that wine was paired with that food, where the vineyard was in the region that wine came from, the family that owned that land or vineyard, and the history behind that family. It's all very interesting, right? So my brother and his wife, they recognize a good drinking opportunity, then they go for it. And they're asking questions. Ha, 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 ha. Now, me, I'm already 13 years sober, so I'm trying all the Diet Cokes of the region. Keep asking for a story about that. And the waiter's like getting embarrassed for me. No. Right. But my mother, she's always been, throughout her life, she has become a master at avoiding drinking. Through her business and her life, she's often put in situations where there's drinking. Even today, at 90 years old, she gets these lifetime achievement awards, and she's in these very high settings, and there's alcohol put in front of her. And she just sort of like doesn't even think about it; just puts it off to the side and just carries on. She's been a master at that, and I've watched it. intently watched. How do you do that? But anyway, I know she doesn't really like to drink, and after about two or three of these tiny little glasses that she barely sipped, and she was engaging the waiter, she says to the waiter, "Don't even bother anymore, don't bring me any more," she says. And I go, "Mom, come on, I'm driving, for God's sake, have a little more. Really, have a little more," and she says something really interesting. She says, No, I don't like the way it makes me feel." Should have left well enough alone. But of course, I needed to follow that up with the question. I followed it up with a million-dollar question. "Mom, how does it make you feel?" And she said something very interesting. She said, "Carl, I'm sitting here having truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I am looking at the beautiful colors of the French countryside at sunset. And the colors are just so vibrant, and my eyes are coming alive. And the music, the string quartet, Carl, the music is rattling my bones. And I'm here talking with three of the people I love the most in the world. And Carl, if I were to drink a little bit too much alcohol, the colors will start to get blurry and dull. The music will start to sound shallow and off in the distance. And I will have a very hard time keeping a conversation going with you." Do you get that? That is fundamentally the opposite relationship to alcohol than I have. Because what she's saying is, of and by herself, she can see the colors of life. She can hear and feel the music. And she can connect with God's other kids. And she adds a little bit of alcohol and it all gets dull, blurry, and sloppy. You see, me, of and by myself, I cannot see the colors of life. I cannot hear the music, and you're goddamn boring. I get four or five drinks in me, and, "Do you see those colors? The music. I'll tell you where that cello was made. Whether I know or not, I can make up the name of a German village on the spot. And you become very interesting. But not as interesting as me." And you see, that is my natural state in the world without alcohol. That is the spiritual malady from my point of view. There's many other descriptions of the spiritual malady and the things that people face, and there's many other symptoms that all... I mean, if you work with other people, you know there's not one type of spiritual malady going on around AA. Right? There's all sorts of weird, abnormal responses to life that we all got to deal with. But man, it seems like the one common thread is alcohol fixes it. It fixes it beautifully. It's why I believe... Why Alcoholics Anonymous says we must have a deep and vital spiritual rearrangement at the level of our soul, right? That I'm going to have to sooner or later somehow be able to see the colors of life, hear the music of life, and connect with God's other kids without a drink, or I'm not staying. I believe it's a fundamental idea why we work the steps. The steps put us in a position that we can then seek that by helping others, by putting us in a position to be of service and be effective in other people's lives. All of a sudden, I get to see the colors of life, hear the music, and connect with you. It's really, and you know what? It can happen without our permission. Right? We don't even need to know any of this. I didn't know any of this until I was double-digit sobriety. Right? I didn't understand what was happening to me, what Alcoholics Anonymous was doing to me. I just showed up and said, "Where do you want me to go to next?" I think that's enough out of me. Thank you.
Is it me? Am I next? Where'd you go? Okay. Hey, family, my name's Amanda Brown. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I was in the process of losing my spiritual fitness right before this meeting. Not kidding.
You know, because we did the workshop this morning, it went so good, and we got up here, and nobody told us what to do, and Carl said, well, why don't we just go in speaker order? And I love that, because I was last, and I was right up my alley, and I felt like, you know, I would get to be last and fill in the holes, whatever they didn't get to say. So then we come down here a while ago, and Katie said, okay, you're going first. To me. I was like, wait a minute, why? Who said that? Well, Robert. Well, sounds like Robert's in control. Why is Robert all of a sudden in control? Why can't we do what we did this morning? And we had a good thing going, and Why are you telling us what order we got to be in? Well, he wants to shake it up. Well, I just don't know if I like that. Literally. They would tell you. They were witnesses. And I had to pile them. I said, you know what? Let me shut up. I need to go pray. That's spiritual malady. Oh, my God. You know, and I mean, really. You know, sometimes it's easier for me to tell you what the opposite looks like, then, you know, I have a pretty good, I believe, I have a pretty good understanding today of what I look like, what I sound like, what I talk like, how I act when I'm spiritually fit. So that now, when I'm not, it does not feel good to me today. I had to call Robert last week, and I'm like, look, what's this spiritual malady workshop all about? What are you looking for? What is it that you're wanting us to share about? What are you looking for in our experience, strength, and hope? And he said a few things, you know, and not only what did it look like when we were drinking. I have no idea what time I started. Okay. Not only what did it look like when we were drinking, but what does it look like now? What does it look like in our sobriety? Spiritual malady for me is the isms. It's the isms of the alcoholism. And I will share with you times when I know that I was suffering in that spiritual malady. And I have had some times in where I have suffered that in sobriety. You know, before I got sober, I'm absolutely selfish and self-centered, and I'm mad at God, and I was raised with that Southern Baptist God and hellfire and brimstone, and I'm angry at God, and I'm pissed off at God, and I don't have anything to do with God. And then we come into AA, and now my sponsor wants me to talk to God. And you know, when I got sober, I had three books. I had the big book, I had the 12 and 12, and I had the little black book, the 24-hour day book. And I still have that. And if you're in my lineage, you're reading that book. That little black book helped me more than anything else to want to have a relationship with the God of my experience. And that little black book talked to me in a way that I could understand about having that experience with the God of my experience. Restless, irritable, and discontent. That's what spiritual malady looks like to me today. And I can still get that way in my sobriety. Anytime that I'm not spiritually fit, anytime that I'm not doing the things that I'm supposed to do. And the spirit that I believe in has given me a few examples that I'm supposed to bring up. You know, the book talks about that one of the purposes of this book, or the purpose of this book, is to get you to a power that you can believe in. It's to get you to a power that is so big that you can rely on that power. Because self-will and self-knowledge is not going to keep us sober. And it is vital. We are to have vital spiritual experiences. So I have had some vital spiritual experiences. The first one was that first awakening, doing those 12 steps. I want to skip to 3.5 years sober. I had been working my program, working with my sponsor, doing everything that I was supposed to do, going down my meetings, yada, yada, yada. You know, living the sober life. And I had a good job, I had a good man, and all of a sudden a lady at work wanted me to go dancing on a Friday night. And I said, sure, I love to dance. I've been dancing since I was 4 years old. It was my first major in college. I love to dance. So we all go out dancing. So the next week she comes over and she said, we're going to go out dancing Friday night. You want to go? Yeah, let's go. I'm having a good time. Let's go. So unbeknownst to me, this is all hindsight, looking back, it became a pattern. Well, I wasn't telling my sponsor where I was going on Friday night. Well, now, see, that creates a problem for me, because if I'm not telling my sponsor where I'm going on Friday night, well, that means I got to stop talking to God, because I don't want God to know what I'm doing, right? That's my alcoholic thinking, people. Hang on. You know. Well, okay, so I'm not telling my sponsor what I'm doing on Friday night, and I'm not talking to God about it. Well, I'm missing the Friday night home group meeting, because it was a clubhouse, and they don't know where I am. And so this pattern, okay, and I don't really realize that until one night I'm standing there, and I realized how easy it would be to pick up that Miller Lite long neck off that table next to me. And it scared me to death. And that was back in the days of payphones, and I got on the payphone right outside the dance club and called my sponsor, and she met me at the clubhouse at 2 o'clock in the morning on that back porch, and we went back to the big book, and she talked to me about the crossroads. And here I was standing at a crossroads. Do I really believe I'm an alcoholic? Have I really conceded in my innermost self that I am an alcoholic and that I can never drink again? And we went back through the steps. And I learned a couple of things during that process, and one was that I have to keep going through the steps. I'm always going to have alcoholism in me. I don't necessarily have to die an alcoholic death, and I don't necessarily believe that that means you die drunk. But I have to keep peeling the layers of this onion because I'm still an alcoholic. The alcoholism is still in me. 7.5 years sober, went through a whole nother thing, you know, living in white rage, and my husband walks in the house and he's breathing, and I'm throwing plates, and I'm screaming, and I'm hollering. And what had happened was my sponsor had gone back out at 8 years sober. And here I am with no sponsor. Well, I don't have a sponsor. Why do I have to go to meetings? First time in sobriety, well, first time in my life I had ever seriously considered suicide. And two angels in skin showed up at my place that day and had me call somebody, and I had my butt in a meeting that night. See, looking back in hindsight, I had stopped doing, but alcohol is a subtle foe. It is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It lies to me. It wants to kill me. I have the same character defects today that I had 27 years ago. They're just dressed up better with better shoes and better purses. It's the same fears. It's the same character defects. It's all the same. Now, I have a little more practice in dealing with them today because I keep going through the steps, and I keep learning new ways to do this, but it all comes back to my solution. And my solution is that higher power that I believe in. 17.5 years sober. We've moved to Montgomery. I don't know anybody. My husband's working for the military base over there. My home group is 1.5 hours one way. I made that trip for weeks and weeks and weeks. I would go back to that home group 1.5 hours one way. Well, then I had a baby. Well, then I had another baby. I'm nursing these babies. I ain't got time to be driving 1.5 hours one way trying to get to a meeting. I've got these two little bitties. I'm exhausted all the time. I'm exhausted all the time. I can't make that drive. I'm too tired. I can't make that drive. I'm too tired. I just can't do it. I had stopped calling my sponsor. My excuse was that I had these two little babies. I had stopped making that drive. And my grandmother had got diagnosed with COPD and emphysema. And she raised me. She raised me. She basically was my mother. And so we get a call that day. My two little bitties are in mother's morning out. My husband is at work. And we get the call that day, and we know on this day that Meemaw is going to die. And it was the first time in sobriety that I had lost somebody. And immediately I'm hit with grief and pain and all of these emotions that I have never felt before in sobriety. And it scared me to death, and it's awful, and I don't like this feeling. And I don't like feeling grief, and I don't like feeling sad. I don't want to lose my Meemaw, and what am I going to do when she dies? And what's going to happen to me? Because I'm still selfish. And immediately the thought came to me, Amanda, when you see us right there, you can be drunk in 15 minutes. Now, I will tell you, and I mentioned something about this earlier, I have found that if I am trying, the God of my experience knows the desires of my heart. And if I am trying, He will give me a moment of grace. He will give me a moment of clarity. And right in that moment, when I thought about taking that drink, the poster in the clubhouse appeared before my eyes. It said, think, think, think. Now, I will tell you, as a newcomer, they told me not to look at that poster. That poster was not for me. But on this particular day, it was about to save my life. I said, okay, Amanda, you've had the first thing. You thought about taking the drink. What's the second thing? What would that look like? I would lose my husband. He's been with me since my first year of sobriety. I would lose my relationship with my mother. I would lose my relationship with my grandmother. You know, I've never had a Zima. I wonder what a Zima tastes like. They got vodka bottles now that light up, play music, play all these pretty colors. Well, if I'm going to do that, why don't I just go down to the west side? Maybe this time I will have courage to stick a needle in my arm or take a bunch of pills, because I don't know that I have the strength and the courage to go back into that room. What's the third thing? Amanda, what are you going to do? I picked up the phone and I called my grand sponsor, and she was down there at my old home group, and she said, Amanda, you've got to find a meeting right now in Montgomery. And that's the day I found my first home group there in Montgomery. So that's what spirituality looks like for me. When I'm not doing the things that I'm supposed to do, when something is blocking me from God, I got convicted a few years ago. We were at a conference here in Atlanta, and KDP was up there talking, and she was doing steps 6 and 7. And she started talking about Candy Crush. Y'all know that game? At that time in my life, I was playing so much Candy Crush that when I would close my eyes in bed to go to sleep at night, I was seeing moves. And she convicted me that day. Because what I realized was that was taking time away from my family. I was obsessing over this freaking game. It was a point of conversation with everybody that I was talking to. Well, that's time that I could be using helping somebody else. That's time that I could be with my family. It was getting between me and the power that I believe in. I will tell you, if you go on my Facebook right now, there's a little black square that says temporarily closed for spiritual maintenance. Because recently I have discovered Facebook's causing me to want to be ugly. It's causing me to want to say things to people that normally I would not say. It is affecting my spiritual fitness. And so I have had to block that. Also, some people use that as a form of communication. You know what? I want you to pick up the phone and call me. At least text me. Where's my human interaction? So I'm not on Facebook right now. Because it's getting between me and my higher power. And I will tell you, anytime I do something like that, I find more time to spend with the power that I believe in. I find more time to spend out in nature to be with my Creator. I find more time to spend one-on-one with the women and the men that I'm working with. God has used that time for His will, not mine. Because see, when I'm doing those things, I'm in self-will. When I have put anything in between me and my higher power, I am in self-will. I lose women to money, gambling, sex, having orgies, cheating on their husbands, cheating on their partners, pills, had to have a surgery, I'm not taking my stuff as directed. Look, the latest trend right now, I don't understand it, is people abusing Benadryl. 4 or 5 a night to go to sleep. Well, honey, that's not what that's for. That's spiritual malady. Maybe it's food. I recently went through a time in the last 2 years where I have really started looking at my spiritual fitness and how that relates to what I am eating and when I am eating. I had to really look at, why am I having that iced honey bun in bed at 9 o'clock at night? Folks, when you stop doing that, the weight comes off. When I am not spiritually fit, I'm eating the whole freaking bag of Oreos. My name is literally written on it in Sharpie. The kids cannot have any. With my glass of milk. When I'm spiritually fit, 1 or 2 suffice. When I'm spiritually fit, I'm not near as hungry. When I'm spiritually fit, I'm practicing self-care. I'm taking care of me. I'm doing the things that I need to do so that I can be a vessel for the power that I believe in. And that's all in sobriety. That's all in sobriety. I can get crazier than a bed bug right now. Now, I'm hoping, you know, it's progress, not perfection, that it doesn't take me as long to come back around to get right side. It doesn't take me as long to come back around and get my force field back up. It seems to get back up a lot faster than it used to. I don't have to sit there today. Sitting in the middle of restless, irritable, and discontent does not feel good to me anymore. I don't like that. I'd rather get the goody from being happy, joyous, and free. I'd rather get the goody from helping one of God's kids. What am I doing today? God, I wake up in the morning and I say, God, what are you up to today and how can I be a part of it? Now, that took a lot of practice. I didn't get sober and was immediately this vision you see before you today. This has been peeling a lot of layers of my onion. And I'm going back through the steps with my new sponsor right now. And I really did get a haircut Wednesday. And because of, I'm still trying to grow. I'm still trying to grow to be the woman of dignity and grace that the God of my experience would have me be today. And I think I'm over my time. Thank you for letting me share.
Well, how do you follow that? That's a spiritual dilemma. Thanks. Oh my God. All right. I'm sure I'll put you to sleep after that. I'm Jerry Weaver. I'm an alcoholic. Very good to be here. Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Amanda. My earliest memory as a kid would be, I guess, described as fear. And I really didn't understand fear as a kid, obviously, but I know that I was absolutely just consumed with it. And I was afraid of people. I was just afraid of the world. I thought that people were out to get me. I thought that I was supposed to just automatically know stuff that I didn't know. And, you know, looking back on it, I mean, I would have told you that I didn't have anybody to talk to and that nobody understood. It really wasn't true. I could have absolutely talked to my parents or some grandparents or asked them questions, but I was a guy who was afraid. I was afraid to do that. And I was absolutely just separated from the world for no real reason, no real good reason. It was just kind of inherently in me. And I was isolated, and that night I drank that whiskey in the basement of that house. All that fear and that confusion and doubt about who I was and about my life just disappeared. And essentially that night I had a spiritual experience. And I know now that they call alcohol, been calling it alcohol spirits for ever since man been crushing grapes, because it induces a spiritual experience. And that night, the feelings that I had about myself and the feelings that I had about other people changed. The thoughts that I had about my place on the earth and my purpose changed, and alcohol gave me, you know, it gave me power that up and by myself I didn't have. It was temporary, unfortunately. But it basically helped me to have a spiritual experience, and that, again, words I wouldn't have known as a 12-year-old kid, but the spiritual deficiency, the spiritual dilemma, spiritual malady that I was in no longer existed when I put the alcohol in me. And, you know, I mean, that's why I drank, because I enjoyed what it did for me. I loved the way that it made me feel. And I love the fact that it allowed me to do things and to experience things that otherwise, I mean, I couldn't do it on my own. And I'm a guy that alcohol worked every time I drank. Those first two or three drinks always took the edge off, always made that initial fear and terror go away. Up to the last day, I'm not a guy that I don't think it ever quit working. I mean, I got to the point where I couldn't control it. I drank myself into alcoholism, and I would just miss the mark every time I drank. But those first two or three drinks always, it always worked. And, but you know, what happened was when I became alcoholic and the world became dark and I started violating every principle that was ever known to man, I started doing things that I didn't, you know, I really didn't want to do. I was always a guy that I always had these good intentions inside, and I always wanted to be loving and compassionate and helpful to people. And I'd make small attempts at it, but I never could put those intentions into actions. And I would always make the wrong decision, or I'd hurt somebody, or I'd make fun of somebody, or I'd put somebody in an awkward position and laugh about it, and then sometime later I'd get absolutely conflicted about it. And I you know, really hated what I was doing. And you know, when I became suicidal and attempted suicide three times, I mean, that was a serious spiritual malady. And you know, and I got to a place where I didn't think I could talk to anybody, or that nobody would understand. And when I got sober, I was told and taught very early on that I had to find a substitute for the alcohol to help me with what the doctor Silkworth describes as restless irritable discontent. And that if I don't find a substitute for that, and if I don't find something to replace that, that I'll get back to being restless, irritable, and discontent. And then my mind will tell me that taking a drink is a good idea. And what happened for me is I was, as I said last night, I was immediately introduced to our literature and to the steps, and was told that that was the solution to the spiritual malady, the spiritual dilemma, and that that was the only thing, if I was alcoholic, that would really fix that. And when I started taking those steps, I started to change. And I love in our book where it talks about that idea of God is inside of us, and that we cover it up. And that's certainly what I did. I mean, I covered up that spirit that was inside of me through the way that I lived, and by stuffing the stuff inside of me and putting stuff inside of me, and being selfish and self-centered, and being full of fear, and worshiping things of money and women and things like that. All that stuff that is inside of me is what blocks me off from that spirit. The purpose of those steps is to uncover that stuff, and that once I share that with somebody and try to get rid of it, that leaves room inside of me for that spirit to be awakened. That leaves room for that spirit to come alive. And that's what happened to me slowly over time. Sometimes you hear people talking today and they get sober and it sounds like they automatically just get better and their life is perfect. But that's certainly isn't the case for any of us. Slowly over time, as I started to take different actions, my life started to change. And I started to awaken to believe that there was a power there that cared for me, that there was a power there that loved me, that there was a power in the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous that would help me find that power that basically would be my defense against the first drink. And that's basically what happened to me. And as I worked those first 9 steps of our program, those promises, I mean, to me, that's the description of the spiritual awakening. That's what happened to me, was that I started slowly, that fear started to go away, and I started to see that I could have some value in life, and that I could actually do something successfully, and that I actually could support myself. And I started to find a purpose through taking those first 9 steps. Now, I'm like a lot of other people that you've heard. I mean, when I was sober 3 or 4 years and went through that situation where I was, I was stealing money from work, and my wife had left. I can remember when my wife left. Now, that was a spiritual dilemma. She actually, I didn't tell this last night, she actually went to the beach with my parents. I couldn't go because I had to work. And she met the guy that she left me for while she was with my parents at the beach. And that's a blow to ego there when you're like, man. But the reality of it was I didn't want that to happen. And I was stealing that money from work, and I was absolutely conflicted about it. And the harder I tried not to do it, the better thief I became. When I was trying to do it on my own, the harder I worked on that defect of stealing, the better thief I became. And but I got into a really, really dark spot, and I started blaming God. And my wife had—I remember laying in that apartment that we were living in at that time, and she hadn't paid the electric bill, and the lights got turned off, and we had this old dog that had fleas, and the place was infested with fleas. And I can remember sitting there on the couch, like kind of crying a little bit, and thinking, like, man, look at what you've done to me. I'm sober about 4 years at this time. I'm like, look at what you did to me, God. And I don't think God had anything to do with it. I think that my own decisions and my own selfishness and self-centeredness and my own fear caused that to happen, because I made decisions based on self, and I made decisions that were absolutely based in fear that caused that to happen. But I know that's one of those spots where if I don't make a different decision, if I don't do something, then that I'll get restless, irritable, and discontent, and drinking will become a good idea, and I'll be off to the races. luckily, I got honest with my sponsor, and I thank God for good sponsorship. Because when I got honest with my sponsor, a path was shown to me of how to get better and how to get out of that through trusting and believing in that power and getting back to applying steps in my life. And I love that spot in the book, and this was pointed out to me, that I limit the power of God. I doubt the power of God. I doubt that power is going to take care of certain things, so I got to get in there and try to fix it. And the on page 52 in our book, it describes a spirituality pretty good, especially if you've been sober and you go through that. It talks about having problems with personal relationships and you can't control your emotional nature and can't make a living and you're not being a real help to other people. And, that's kind of where I was at 4 years sober. And it meant that I had to get serious about life. I had to get serious about, do I really believe in that power of God, or do I just give it lip service? Am I really willing to trust, or do I just want to keep playing games? And, luckily I recommitted. I went all in on Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've never looked back since. Now, I have had times over the years where, I get to periods where I doubt and I start questioning things. And that's when I'm reminded by my sponsor that my job is just to give up, and my job is to trust that same power that's helped me for the last however long it's been will help me today. I just got to kind of stay out of my head. And what's happened to me, I guess, over time here is that I've learned to lose dependencies on other people. And I've learned to lose my dependencies on material things and outside things that really don't, that come and go, they're temporary. And that my job is really to try to trust and believe completely in that power. And sometimes that power comes to me through people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes it might come through a meeting. Certainly comes through prayer and through meditation. But if I'm going to stay spiritually fit, and if I'm going to continue to grow spiritually, then that's for me where step 10, 11, and 12 come in. That I've got to do a few things. I got to be current in my hunger. I got to be current with my sponsor. I can't have any secrets. I got to be completely open and honest, and I got to help other people. And the funny thing about it for me is the very same things that I was taught as a newcomer are the very same things that save my butt every day today. Get to my home group early, make coffee, sit out some chairs, welcome people when they come, stay late, take down the chairs, clean the coffee pot. I don't give that to a newcomer. I'll fight a newcomer over a coffee pot. And go buy your own coffee pot. Have a service commitment, help people, pray and meditate every day. The very simple, basic things are what help me to stay, help my maintain my spiritual condition. It doesn't need to be any more than that. That's my problem, is I'm always thinking there's got to be more and there's got to be another level. And when it comes to just basic spiritual maintenance, more will get you in trouble. So I just got to do simple, basic things to keep that. To stay spiritually fit. So thank you.
My name is Jim Turner and I'm an alcoholic. So when I spoke the other night, I talked about coming into AA, and I was not an atheist because it seems to me that being an atheist is a lot of work. You got to disprove the existence of God. And I'm way too lazy for that. I like to refer to myself at the time as an agnostic with a bad attitude. I think for me, early on, alcohol did something to me that nothing else on this planet has ever done for me early on. And it made, in the doctor's opinion, where it talks about the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once the taking of a few drinks, the drinks I see others take with impunity, which means without punishment. That would change my world. It changed my perception. It fixed everything inside of me. I realized a little while after I got sober that every decision I made my entire life was fear-based. Every single one. And I could have passed a lie detector the day before I came into AA if you'd have said, "Are you fearful?" I didn't know it. I had no clue. I think we're extremely fortunate in here. I believe the wisdom of our co-founders in the first 100. There are four words in our 12 steps, and they occur in step 3 and they occur in step 11 that kept me alive. And it's as we understood him. Those four words allowed me to grow. I didn't have to pigeonhole myself into somebody else's belief. You know, AA says we would prefer that you believe in something. What you choose to believe in is entirely up to you. We think it's a really good idea that you find something, though. You know? It says, and Amanda touched on this, it says, my favorite chapter early on in the big book was chapter 4, We Agnostics. And it says in there, and if I don't get it right, sue me. It says in there, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power which could solve our problem. But how and where were we to do this? In the next paragraph, it starts off and it says, well, that is the main purpose of this book. Its main object is to help you find a power greater than yourself by which you can live. Now, I find that interesting because the book is called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the main purpose of the book is not to help me stop drinking. The main purpose of the book is to help me find a power greater than myself by which I can live. That's bizarre. I shared the other night about the International Convention. And I want to share something else about the International Convention that has nothing to do with inmates or prison or anything like that. I did not go to the International in 2010 in San Antonio. I came up with some lame excuse to my sponsor why I couldn't go. I don't even remember what it was. It was so ridiculous. And I told him, I said, I will go to the International Convention in Atlanta. And he told me, before we came over here for the International, he said, I want you to pay attention to something. He said, when you get to Atlanta, just get a feel for what it feels like. And he said, as more and more AA members come, get a feel for what that feels like. And I thought, what the hell is he talking about? His first International was Toronto, and he went to San Antonio, and Atlanta was his third. And so I remember when we got over here, Barbara and I came over on Tuesday night, and we checked into the hotel right there at the Dome and right there at the World Congress Center. And we live out sort of in the country, and it's real quiet at night where we live. And I didn't sleep a wink that Tuesday night because every other second it seemed like there was a siren going off or car horns or all this craziness was going on. And I thought, my God, this is unbelievable. You know? And it's interesting because as the week progressed on, we had 57,000 AA members show up from 118 countries. They came from all corners of the earth. And they showed up here in Atlanta. And something started to shift. I wasn't able to put my finger on it, but something started to shift. The night after the big meeting in the Dome on Saturday night, Barbara and I went back to the hotel room. Do you know how many sirens I heard that night? One. Now, was that because I was used to it? No. No, it didn't have anything to do with it. It was because there was one siren that night. We, as individual AA members, having overcome the spiritual malady, carry something in us that's native to every faith tradition on this planet. And it's called gratitude. We had 57,000 AA members here expressing love and gratitude. That was the energy that each and every one of us carried, except for one person. I always saw one person having a bad time, and she was a volunteer. But everybody else did great. You know? And so I could just sense it. It was palpable. You could feel the shift in the energy because of all of these people that were happy, joyous, and free. And so I got home after the International Convention, and I got thinking about it. And I remember that I read an article from San Antonio, from the International there, that they'd interviewed a cab driver. And he said, "I loved this convention. Nobody threw up in my cab. Nobody stiffed me. Everybody tipped well. They were unbelievably well behaved." And so I started looking. And so I Googled crime in Atlanta on that weekend. Do you realize that on that weekend, there was not one murder committed in Atlanta? And then I thought, well, let's look a little further, shall we? There was not one violent crime reported that weekend. Now, there may have been some violent crime. It was not reported. Now, did 57,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous cause that? I don't know. I checked a bunch of other weekends. That was not the case. We come in here and we're powerless over alcohol. And what they don't tell us is we're powerless over everything in the universe except ourselves. And that's fact and that's true. It's a hard lesson to learn, but it's fact and it's truth. As individuals, this is not AA's responsibility to change the world. But as individual members of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the 12 steps and the power there within, as individuals, we can make a change. We can make a difference. And although I have no way to prove this, I am firmly convinced that July 4th weekend in 2015, we had an effect on the entire population of this city. I believe that. I used to hear something in meetings and they would say, you know, alcoholics are just like normal people, only more so. I firmly believe that. And I think that we have something magical here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We tell stories. Do you realize before there was written language, that is how everyone learned, was to sit around and tell stories. We do things that the ancients used to do. We're reaching back. We sit and look at each other in the eye. We fellowship. We talk. We connect. I'll offer this before I close. Would you agree with me that there are more people on the planet today than there's ever been before? Yeah. Fair enough, right? Would you also agree that there's a greater sense of loneliness on this planet than there ever has been before? Yeah. I think everybody would agree to that. Not in here. Not in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are given a way to retake our power, to connect, to do all of the things that humans, because we may be alcoholics, but we're still human. You know, and we suffer from a human spiritual condition. And I'm just grateful to be a part of something that gave me a solution. Thank y'all.
Y'all, we got 40 minutes, so we have a lot more time than we had this morning, and we don't even have anything right afterwards, so, I mean, there's plenty of time. Like I said earlier, you can go over to that microphone and ask a question. You guys can take your time answering it, and we'll just go from there. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, stay up here and facilitate, but I do want you to know there's a good bit of time left. So. Who's first? Or do you want to raise your hand from your seat, if that's more comfortable? Carl, do you think of something you left out? You sure? I mean, you told some great stories, but I'm sure you got more.
I have a question. Woo-hoo! Hi, Jim.
Excellent.
My question is for Jim. I wondered if you could give us any update on Jason.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's been probably a year and a half since I've spoken with Jason. He got released from Walker State Prison. I think it was July 31st. I can't remember if it was 2016 or 2017. It was not too terribly long after he spoke at the International. And he moved home, which is Hull, Georgia, which is just north of Athens a little bit. And we got together. You know, it was interesting. After the International, people gave me stuff for Jason, like little trinkets and books, and I had a box like this big. And he called me when he got out, and I said, "Dude, you need to come to my house. I got a bunch of stuff for you here." And so he came over, and we actually got on the phone together and called Eva at GSO, which was really cool, and talked to her, and she was so thrilled. And then he. He ended up getting a really good job. You know, he was on the fire team at Walker, and he was actually on my fire team at Jackson County Correctional, where I met him as well. And so he got a job installing commercial sprinkler fire systems in warehouses and that kind of stuff. Got a really good job. And he did such a great job, his boss, within like 3 months, promoted him to supervisor. And he got a company vehicle. And for a while, he would go with me into correctional facilities in Athens and do meetings. And those guys that got to hear him live really were in for a treat. You know, it was great. And he got busy. And he got a girlfriend. And he moved up to somewhere north of Gainesville. I'm not really exactly sure where. And I heard maybe a year ago he got married. And that's all I know. You know, I did tell him that you're going to need to get a sponsor up there, somebody can keep their eye on you. You know, and whether he did or not, I don't know. But I will say this. After the International Convention, the whole reason that Eva did that deal was we have a decrease in the amount of correctional volunteers from AA at the time. And Eva's whole purpose in doing that was she wanted to rekindle the energy in our correctional volunteers. And so that's why she did that whole thing. And so what I didn't say Thursday night, within 2 months of him speaking at the International, we had correctional facility meetings started in Australia, Japan, and South Korea, where they'd never really done them before. He got letters from people, AA members, who were there and who were not there that day, from 33 different states and 3 foreign countries, including 3 marriage proposals. He politely declined the 3 marriage proposals. And he wrote everybody that wrote him back. And that's just the kind of kid he is. He wrote, and when people were writing him back, he would continue writing. Back and forth, back and forth. Now, the funny thing was, a lot of our AA members don't understand correctional facilities very well. And so there was a few people that what they would do is they'd write him a letter and put a $50 bill in it and send it to the prison. And he'd see the lady from the mailroom coming across to the firehouse with some letters in her hands, and she'd come up and she'd go, "Hey, Jason, you got some more contraband from your AA friends." And so they'd have to send the money back, say, "You can't do that," that kind of stuff. But it was really cool to see the response that he got from literally all around the world. So, to my knowledge, all's well. I don't know.
I'm intrigued by the discussion of work within correctional facilities, and on the talk of spiritual malady. And if any of you could just shed some significant moment or connection beyond Jason that you've had within a correctional facility that would be beneficial to this audience.
My name's Carl, an alcoholic. I just have a really good thing to say about somebody else who does this stuff. Obviously, you've done spectacular work. I was there on in 2015, and that kind of moved me big time. But this time, I was in Missouri, and this friend of mine, Harold L., who is also very, very involved in corrections, and I saw something that I had never seen before. I often wind up going into prisons when I come to various places when I travel around. I've been to prisons all over the country. I've been had an amazing time at a prison in Gävle, Sweden, where they've set up, it's maximum security, and the whole section of a prison is set up like a men's recovery house to simulate that they're in a recovery house, and everybody in there talks 12 steps, including the guards. It's really quite amazing. It's a good thing because you go to prison for your second DUI. In Sweden. Did you know that? If you you never drive again in your life after 2 DUIs. They're pretty serious about this drinking and driving thing out there. But anyway, so I've been to a lot of these over the last 30 years, a lot of them. And I often see the fellow that often takes me in wherever I'm going. The inmates often know the person's name, because they come every once a month, and so the inmates all know their name. But I saw something really amazing. Harold took me into, again, maximum security, where these are all lifers. And there's about 70 men at this meeting. And Harold stood at, and he'd been doing it for the last 10 years. And Harold stood at the door, and not only did they know his name, he knew every single one of their names. Right. He reached out and knew them by their first name. They weren't wearing name tags. Knew them by their name and asked them questions about their life. All 70 of them. I was just amazed at the level of that kind of interaction. Another funny one in Iceland, they have a maximum security, but it's really just a little fence. A tiny little fence for a maximum security because it's really in the middle of nowhere. Right? You drive for 3.5 hours through snow and you find this. and there's a little kid drinking a Monster guarding the gate, right? And right, they don't care. They go ahead, get out of here, have a good time. But they all love to talk Alcoholics Anonymous, and the biggest escape they had is one. Apparently somebody, one of the a member of Blackwater, you guys know what that is, mercenaries of the, right, was arrested in downtown Reykjavik and was put in there. And they just let a Blackwater helicopter fly in. He walked out the gate, got in, and went. They just said, fine, he's off our island. So, anyway, those are some interesting, fun things in correction.
We're going to take one more question from it's a gentleman that is so faithful to the Land Roundup Committee. I can't tell you. Thomas is going to have one last question, then we'll shut it down.
Oh, you beat me.
Okay, sorry, Larry. Let Thomas go first.
Sure.
Hey, Thomas. But I've been doing these things on and off for almost 30 years. But I'm going to say this, and I need help.
My name's Larry. I'm an alcoholic, and I was a little late, but it's more to, you know, I'm a 45-time convicted felon. I've been to prison 3 times in 3 different states, and I spent a lot of time locked up. And when it comes to the hand of fellowship being extended to a convict, if it wasn't for men in my home group who carried the message to me at a point in time when I was ready for it, I wouldn't be here today. You know, AA has never turned me away. And, you know, the men that do that and the ladies who do it, you know, I know there's room for women to do it too. It's my higher power, and this program has saved my life and kept me from, I should be in prison for the rest of my life or dead. You know, and those men selflessly, came in and shared the message with me, you know, so, and it happens everywhere, all over the country, and I guess all over the world, but if you have the opportunity, and these men weren't convicted felons, they just had a message of love and hope to carry, there was 30 of us at that time, 2 of us, I didn't stay sober, but my friend Rick did, and it's because of the men in my home group that were willing to do that, so if you ever have an opportunity, it's worth it. Thanks.
Wow. Between Thomas and Larry right there, I mean, it's some serious stuff. Thanks for sharing from the heart with you guys. Does anybody have anything else they want to say? Would you like to go ahead and close with the Lord's Prayer? All right. Thank you.